Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to another Curzon Film Podcast. This week, everybody knows there's a new Javier Bardem. Everybody knows Penelope Cruz. Everybody knows it's out this week, and we'll do our best to give you our critique. That's how it goes, because we're also talking about The Kindergarten Teacher. How are we doing, guys? I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining me around a very small table that I've arranged specifically to place us inside the mise-en-scene of The Kindergarten Teacher are my fellow classmates, Stephen Ryder.
Hello.
Ella Kemp.
Hello.
And Kelly Powell.
Hello.
All right, so along with that lovely chat about The Kindergarten Teacher and everybody knows, we'll be talking to The Kindergarten Teacher's star, Maggie Gyllenhaal, who Kelly was lucky enough to speak to, and we'll be bringing that to you in just a bit. But we will start with Everybody Knows, which was the opening film from last year's Cannes Film Festival. Oscar-winning filmmaker Asghar Farhadi brings together Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem for a Madrid wedding. But Everybody Knows, it's not a rom-com with Farhadi at the helm. You may know him for his slow-burn dramas, A Separation and The Salesman, but here he sets his clinical eye more in the realm of genre as the film shifts into a psychological thriller and old rumours of Cruz's Laura jilting her hometown lover Paco, that's Bardem, reignite. When Laura's daughter is kidnapped, a seething mystery worthy of Michael Haneke is unleashed. Stephen, people may know Javier Bardem, they know Penelope Cruz, but who is Asghar Farhadi?
So Asghar Farhadi has kind of had quite a quick rise to the top tier kind of auteurs that always have a film at Cannes or a film at one of the big festivals. And, you know, Everybody Knows was no different when it came out, when it opened the Cannes Film Festival last year. It's taken quite a while to get here, but I mean, Farhadi is such an interesting filmmaker in the sense that he makes films that are very, very intimate films about subjects that we might not really have any personal or cultural connection with, but he somehow manages to get an audience incredibly involved with the culture very, very quickly. He makes films that are not passive at all. They have very kind of tightly constructed scripts, tightly constructed plots, and they move at a very, very quick pace, and they require kind of attention from an audience. And he uses that attention in really interesting ways. He draws your attention in for the story and kind of tricks you into really becoming involved with the atmosphere of the film as well. He's a fantastic filmmaker. His two most famous films, the two that won the Best Foreign Language Oscars, are, of course, The Separation and The Salesman. And people might remember The Salesman from the big event in London.
Yeah, so Sadiq Khan put on the Mayor's screening, which was taking over Trafalgar Square, not traditionally a cinema space.
No.
And putting on The Salesman. And it was just around the time that it just won the foreign language film Oscar. And so it's bringing together a whole load of people in London to watch this film from a foreign language director in the centre of the city was quite an event. And it was great to see so many people coming out to a film like that.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, for such a kind of small scale film about kind of very personal human dramas, it's amazing. I did want to just quote Peter Bradshaw from The Guardian, who I think sums up a lot of Farhadi's films really nicely, in which he says, "The unburied secret, the unhealed wound, the imminent return of the repressed." And it is all of his films, especially Everybody Knows, are about kind of repressing your emotions for what you think at the time is the greater good. It's this film in particular, I feel, is a very it's almost voyeuristic in the way that it kind of films this family and this unit of people that have come together to celebrate a wedding, to the point where you feel a little bit uncomfortable sitting in on their conversations.
And how does this new one kind of tie into his filmography? It's more of a push in the realm of the mainstream, perhaps?
I'd say it was, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's that far removed from a separation, other than its kind of locale and its language, really, in the sense that you have a lot of characters being introduced very, very quickly, and you have to, you know, get to grips with it very quickly. But what I think is really interesting about Everybody Knows is that it moves quite heavily into the realm of melodrama, to the point where it feels like a kind of one of the Spanish telenovelas that it's been compared to quite a lot. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that as an audience you're expected to just kind of like accept, and it can be difficult to get into the film's rhythm, but once you do, I think it's a really worthwhile film.
Okay. And it's a move for language for him as well, and so we've got Kieslowski and Haneke moving to French, Ang Lee with Sense and Sensibility. How do we find that translates from his former language? Do we feel like there are some beats that may have been hit better in his older work?
I mean, I've listened to interviews with Farhadi, and he is quite open about the fact that it was difficult and it was hard for him to kind of make a film in a language that he does not speak, as you'd expect it to be, you know. I think I remember Ang Lee saying that he used it as a reason just not to talk to the actors, because he just pretended he didn't know any English at all. With this film, I think what's so impressive about it, from a director's standpoint, is he manages to draw some incredible performances out of the two leads, especially out of Bardem and Cruz. It's a bit of a shame that Cruz goes missing towards the second half of the film and it kind of shifts over to Bardem, but he is such a good actor at carrying like a film, and you know, he uses his physicality in the most amazing ways, and every time I watch him on screen he you know, his imposing kind of physicality mixed with, I think he's capable of giving very sensitive performances. I think it's a real treat to see this on screen, and it's no different in Everybody Knows.
Yeah. So, Stephen, you were lucky enough to catch this one recently. Ella, I know this was a long time ago since you saw this film, and there was kind of one resting point that I think has been left with you on it.
Well, Jake, I've been thinking a lot about Everybody Knows, and I think there's a point that I don't think it's exclusive to, in brackets, world cinema or Hollywood cinema or any of it. I have noticed that when I watch a film, and the name of the film is used as dialogue more than once, it's not a good film. Now, I'm not saying that Everybody Knows is not a good film at all. And Stephen, you said some wonderful things about it. But the fact is, the words Everybody Knows are used twice at different points of the film. Now, you know, other films do this, and that's fine, on the basis of sex. Many, many times those words were said, and you know, it's important to understand, you know, what you're fighting for. But again, used too many times. The one example, of course, is Call Me By Your Name. You know, they say the words once in one sentence. It's not its own entity, just the title. You know, it's kind of mixed into a more natural thing. And that's the only exception I'll make.
I think you should do like a real like dissertation on this subject.
Oh, I can. Do Twitter, some, yeah, you know, do some send research, me suggestions.
Do some research to how the like AFI 100, how many times the film title is said in each film. And
I can do that.
Yeah.
Well, that neatly draws us onto our next film, which I think begins with Maggie Gyllenhaal saying, "Hello, I am the kindergarten teacher."
She's allowed, Maggie Gyllenhaal.
So Maggie Gyllenhaal plays the kindergarten teacher in this one, directed by Sarah Colangelo, about a kindergarten teacher who craves to be a poet, and she's unsatisfied with family life and her work, and she finds her art lacking in the world. But when one of her pupils shows himself to be a poetic prodigy, her interest takes on dark overtones. Equally mentoring and manipulating, we can only watch as the plot thickens. Sarah Colangelo reimagines this 2014 Israeli film of the same name, and Maggie Gyllenhaal is a fully realized, complex woman in this great film.
And you were lucky enough to speak to Maggie
yes,
all about this film.
Yes, I was. Yeah, it was great to talk to her about it. There's lots to unpack. And we had like a lovely open talk about it, and she's really passionate about this film. And so I hope you enjoy the interview.
Hi, Maggie Gyllenhaal. Welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast.
Thank you
so much for joining us.
Yeah.
So congratulations on this film. I think you're absolutely superb in it.
And Thank you.
I really, really love the film.
Thank you.
You play Lisa, who is a kindergarten teacher, who recognizes that one of her children in her class, Jimmy, is talented and feels the need to nurture that talent, mm-hmm. but takes it a little bit too far.
Mm-hmm.
But you also play a woman who is trying to find her role and identity as a woman and an artist in today's world. Mm-hmm. That feminine sensibility comes out so much in the film.
Right, right. It's right. Sarah doesn't judge her, even though she does things that are incredibly problematic.
Yeah.
So that I think the audience has a chance to make their own judgment or their own, to feel what their own emotional impact is of the things that Lisa's doing.
Exactly, yeah. Did you feel that also on set, like in or during the whole process of the filmmaking? Like, was it a different experience for you? How did it...
You know, it's so interesting. It really was a different experience for me, but I don't think necessarily... I mean, I've worked with many women.
Yes.
And like, for example, the second season of The Deuce,
yes.
7 out of 8 of the directors were women.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's just to do with gender, but it was different. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was. It was like, just the other day, actually, Sarah and I were doing a Q&A together, and someone asked a question about what we were thinking or what we were intending inside of a scene. And Sarah had such a different idea of it than I did. Mm-hmm. And yet that wasn't a problem for us. You know, somehow the differences in the way we thought was what created some of what's interesting.
Exactly.
And there were certainly things that we agreed on. Like we knew, I don't even know if we talked about it explicitly, but I think we both knew in order for the movie to work, she has to be a wonderful kindergarten teacher.
Yes.
She has to be bright and curious and friendly and warm. And then you get on the train with her and you get to watch her it's funny, devolve or like
or unravel in a way
or evolve depending on how you think about it. I mean, you know, by the end of the movie I do think she's kind of come to some really truthful sense about where she actually is for 1 second. But so anyway, those kinds of directorial things, we you know, those were very important. We agreed on them. She wasn't saying to me, oh no, you have to be a gray, broken, obviously sort of sad shadow in the beginning. No, we were both going at it from the same place.
Yeah.
But then the details inside it and the ways that we maybe felt differently about things, we sort of let them coexist.
Yeah, definitely. And it you kind of, as an audience member, you go on this journey and you, because you're so empathetic, like she's so empathetic and you totally get what she's, where she's coming from, that, you know, those decisions that she starts making towards the end, we're not going to ruin anything, but you do, it makes you so uncomfortable, yet you still understand and can't relate to where it's coming
from. Right, and even I think sometimes I feel, I've watched the movie twice with an audience all the way through at Sundance and then at Toronto, and then I've seen the end quite a few times with an audience because I've done these Q&As afterwards. It's kind of interesting to get the feeling in the room at the end. And I think especially sort of midway through, like you say, sometimes I feel audiences do this really interesting thing where they're like, oh, how do I put it? Like there's laughter inside the movie, right? There's like, there's some kind of strange humor.
Yeah, definitely.
And,
she's quirky, you know? She,
yeah, but some of the laughter I think also comes from people laughing at her and going, I was never allied with this insane woman. Mm. You know, I have nothing to do with this. I never was with her or rooting for her. I don't, you know, and that's so interesting. And then the movie brings you right back around to empathizing with her again. She's weeping in the bathroom. She's whatever. Mm-hmm. You see where it's coming from. It's like such a, I think directorially, Sarah did a really beautiful job of allowing the audience to really move back and forth. Mm-hmm. And when they move away from her, sometimes it's really violently and sometimes it's really gently. And it's really, I think, beautifully directed.
I agree. And you're also incredible in it.
Thank you.
I just think, you such a good job of capturing a real woman. You know, you feel that this woman is a real woman in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's also why it's so heartbreaking when her poetry, her own poetry, you know, isn't really ever acknowledged or accepted by any of the men in the film. You
right.
know? Her, Simon, the poetry teacher, at one point, like point blank, says to her that she's not an artist, she's an art appreciator.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband doesn't really get it, I don't think. And, you know, even though it's bizarre that she does it, she seeks Jimmy's approval and he doesn't even give it to her.
Which is really upsetting,
so upsetting. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that seems very upsetting.
So what do you think that the film is trying to say about the way society values art and artists in a world still very much rooted in patriarchy? mm-hmm. patriarchal gaze is like very much the whole.
Well, I think it's so interesting. I have to say a few things about this. First of all, I read a few articles after Sundance where people said just offhandedly in the article, her poetry is mediocre. Now, her poetry is written by a brilliant published poet.
Yeah.
And I think, well, is her poetry the most brilliant genius poetry in the world? Maybe not, but is it compelling and worthwhile? I think it is. And I think to say it's mediocre is a wish. The movie's much easier to watch if her poetry is worthless. And if her poetry is compelling and worthwhile and totally not heard, well, it's much more of a tragedy and it's much more disturbing. And I've even noticed that people, when they write about the movie and say adoring things about the poetry, because the poetry is incredible in the movie. I mean, it's written by these wonderful poets.
Yes.
They only mention the two men. Rarely mentioned. So they mention Ocean Vuong and Kaveh Akbar, and they don't mention Dominique Townsend.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's wild.
Isn't that interesting?
Whoa, this is so much what this movie's about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, right, why does Gael García Bernal, I mean, I always like to make this joke, why does he get to decide which poem? I mean, it's not really him, of course. But you know, just because he's sort of this masculine force in the movie, why does that character get to decide what poetry is worth paying attention to?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's all very disturbing.
Yeah, and it's also interesting that, you know, she frames his recitals as this genius poetry. And she sees that in a male child, and sort of sees that in the idea of the boy genius, and even her own sense of what she thinks is good art is framed by that lens, you know.
Totally, and she thinks her work is worthless too.
Yeah,
I know, and I think, and this is a place where Sarah and I coexisted and disagreed, or not disagreed, but sort of took slightly different positions. I think Sarah believes that she actually finds a boy genius in her class, and that the movie in some ways is an allegory.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think the movie is so subjective and so almost like myopically through her mind that I don't know. I think children say incredible things all the time. And what makes them poems? You know, if you put a frame around it in a particular way, if you make a line break in a particular way, if you missed part of it and fill it in yourself, you know, I think her need is so great to have some kind of a worthwhile artistic interaction that I sort of think a lot of this comes from her own head.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. So even though Lisa's intentions are really good, you know, from the outset, she almost starts to become the same problem she sees in the world by sort of not letting Jimmy be a kid and just experience the world as a kid would, really. And that's where the beauty of his poetry is coming from, this sort of imaginary world that he lives in.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to know, out of interest, how did you guys protect Parker Savak, the little boy who plays Jimmy, whilst making the film? Because I think sometimes, you know, films have the potential to be to kind of do the same thing to child actors.
Yeah, sure, totally. Yeah. Well, I think a lot about this. I mean, I was really deeply, viscerally drawn to the script and to making the movie. There was a moment where I thought about not making it because I thought, I don't know how we can make this movie and protect this kid. And I have a child who is exactly the same age as Parker. And I was very in touch with what it actually means to be five and how really vulnerable it is. And yet the movie is made by, you know, me, Sarah, all of our producers are mothers of young children. So it's made by a group of mothers of young children.
Yeah.
And I basically thought, I also don't think 5-year-olds are actors. And I don't think it's fair to ask them to, you know, mine their minds for whatever connection to this story. So we just kept it extremely technical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we basically were like, when I clap my hands, turn your head and repeat after me, I don't want to go. And then Parker would sort of turn his head and say, I don't want to go. And we'd say, no, sing it like a song. I don't want to go. I don't want to go. You know, and then and he would learn how to this sort of shorthand with either me or Sarah, who'd be on our knees by the camera, to sing it like us. And so that's how we did it. And I think in some ways, Parker's beautiful performance. Yeah. And I think what's so amazing about Parker is he isn't a performer. Mm-hmm. And it's sad to see how early children start performing themselves, especially children who are pushed into acting very young. But he didn't do that. And I think, and he's also very smart. And those things were such assets to us. And yet I would say that what works about his performance is the way that Sarah put it together, because he's a little boy, he's just a little boy.
And you feel that. I think you do. It's like watching. It really felt very real, the whole film. Very authentic in that way.
But then the other thing is like, he could only work, you know, very limited hours.
Yeah.
And so there were lots of times when I would do my side of a scene with our 50-year-old bearded first AD lying on the ground next to the camera. And so really, and I also think that she is really erasing him. And it's terribly disturbing.
Yeah.
And so my relationship, my primary relationship in the movie was not with Parker. And Lisa's primary relationship truly is not with Jimmy. Yeah. It's with herself.
Yeah.
And so all of these things helped protect him from having to feel that his boundaries were crossed, you know? So.
Yeah. I've also heard you say that you see the film as an exploration of what can happen, the detrimental effects that can happen when a woman is starved of her mind, you know, her creativity and her intellect, and when she isn't recognized for any of those things. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you what advice you could give to women who nowadays might find themselves in the same sort of position, you know, like what outlets are there?
God, I don't know. I think it's why we made the movie. I think if another... Okay, Lisa is very extreme. And her waking up to the fact that she's starving... I mean, look, Candy in The Deuce is also waking up to the fact that she's starving. But she goes on a very different kind of road to feed herself. I mean, Lisa's very confused. But I think even just making art that's honest about how desperate and painful it is to be pushed aside, and putting that in an honest way on the table might be helpful to someone feeling things similar.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel that when I feel an experience of mine articulated in a book or a movie. Mm. And it's true, Lisa's really far out there. And obviously her feelings and the things she says and what she's after are not ultimately the message of the movie. You know, she's a very flawed both antagonist and protagonist, but maybe just feeling and seeing her desperation and her confusion, if you relate to it at all, which I hope women will on some level, and men too. Mm-hmm. And maybe men will have to use that muscle, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I've heard a few men say to me, you know, I'm not a woman, but my heart broke for her. I related to her. And I mean, that's another thing I think is really exciting, is to sort of say, because I think it's only great to have more muscles and more experience at relating to stories that are not your own. I mean, that's...
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's another way that we can connect, I think.
Yeah.
And that's important. I mean, that is kind of what art is about, I think, you know? Like,
and learning about yourself.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course.
And learning about an experience that's not yours.
Exactly. Yeah. So is that what you'd say you want audiences to sort of take away from the film? Questioning themselves and, like, you know, making them think, basically, about these things, about these themes that come up, these...
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, another thing I think is kind of... that I feel proud of about the movie is, you know, you can like it or not like it, you can be with her or not be with her, empathize with her or not. But we are offering something fundamentally truthful. And I think in a moment where, at least in America, we're being lied to all the time, and in fact, we're kind of inured to it. I think the experience I want people to have is to be offered the truth and then have the, and then be in charge in their own mind of where they fall in this story emotionally and intellectually, ethically. Because I think most people want to use their minds, and I think most people want the truth.
I agree with you. And just quickly to end off, are you planning on writing, directing anything in the future that we can look forward to? Another female filmmaker on the horizon?
I am. I'm adapting Elena Ferrante's book, The Lost Daughter, into a film that I'm going to direct.
Oh my, that's amazing. I'm very excited for that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thank you.
I really appreciated your time.
Okay, my pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Maggie, for lending us your time there. Why do you think people should be seeking this one out, Kelly?
I think what Colangelo does really well here is contextualize it for the American sort of society where this is set. As far as I know, I think what Ella mentioned, the original sort of follows this boy's perspective, and it's kind of tackling masculinity in a country at war and the value of art there. Whereas this one is very much from a female perspective. It follows Maggie Gyllenhaal's character's perspective all the way through. And it is very much dealing with the value of art in America, how it is valued, how it is appreciated, who has the say on that. And it follows this woman who is trying to enter this in some way, yet her art is deemed not so valuable, not so good. She's called an art appreciator at one stage and not an artist.
Dilettante.
I think that it's an interesting way to tackle, like, you know, American society and sort of the patriarchy in general, especially in these times. It's interesting to look at that and how art is sort of seen as, you know, who has the final say?
Who gets to define what is or isn't
exactly.
Art? And yeah, it's interesting that her own art is completely devalued in this, and it begins to distort her own approach to artistic practice, both within her own work and at a professional level for her work as well.
Yeah.
And that she becomes distorted by others' opinion on how much value she has.
Exactly.
Really.
And it's interesting because I spoke to Maggie about this in the interview, and you know, they made a point to make to the, like, actual poets wrote her artwork for the film. I mean, her poetry for the film. And they made a point to seek out, you know, well-established poets and people who are recognized for their work. So it is actually good poetry. you know, that they are, that she's writing in the film as her character's writing. Yet it's not deemed acceptable. It's not deemed of the standard. But this little boy who starts to go into this weird trance when he's spewing this poetry, you know, she herself places this boy genius sort of label onto him. And it's through her eyes that she sees this potential and wants to, I mean, it's this film play, it walks a line between
understanding the intentions, you know, understanding what she's trying to do, nurture something. You know, she makes such a point of like documenting his poetry. She's like, I don't want this to get lost. And, you know, this is a genius and we need to nurture the soul. Yet it's also a 5-year-old boy. You know, he's a kid. Mm. He might lose this. He might not want to do this. Like, where is the moral line?
But also, I think you have to question, like, how much of this art or how much of this poetry is good from our perspective, or are we just being drawn into her world?
Yeah,
where she's like
totally
putting too much emphasis on how good this poetry is.
Exactly.
Even though people are appreciating it in the film, like, how good is it?
Exactly.
And we have to kind of contend with that as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's kind of unreliable, right? We're seeing the whole world
Absolutely.
Through her eyes.
Yeah.
And I think we touched on that in the interview as well, you know.
It plays on that notion of trust for a teacher.
Exactly.
We as an audience naturally kind mm-hmm. of want to like teachers. and so do the people in the film. And that's her one, even though it's bad practice, that's one way of her to glean power.
Yeah.
Even though she becomes exploitative.
Yes. She loves having power over this cultural kind of object that she thinks can become part of like the wider cultural kind of understanding. She loves being the curator of it.
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly.
But and then like, her poetry class as well that she goes to, then when she reads, you know, poems of all sorts that she's written, some that she might not have written, it's so interesting seeing the reaction from that whole classroom as well. So then that kind of
validates it in
that
a way.
Kind of teases it out, the idea that it's not it might not be just, you know, her character imagining everything. Because then also one thing that differs from the original film is in the new film, Gael Garcia Bernal is cast as the teacher, her poetry teacher, which is fascinating. And he's just such an amazing character because he's completely gormless and there's like nothing to him, but there's just like such a little sparkle in his eye that kind of almost validates everything.
It's Gael Garcia Bernal reading poetry.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
You're going to get into it.
What a fascinating bit of casting that is, though, to put one of kind of Mexico's biggest actor in a supporting role as a poetry teacher. And
but then their
like
relationship,
this.
Like between Maggie Gyllenhaal as Lisa as her teacher and him as well, it becomes much more again than student and teacher, mm-hmm. which and happens in all of like in every relationship in this film. And there, it just I think it reflects the way that Lisa has this very weird relationship with intimacy and affection and just sex and all of it with everyone in her life, like as much the way that she will be intimate with her husband as much as her students, her kids and this teacher. There's kind of a bit of a disconnect between the way you think that like sex should be with a partner and then the way that it is and how that's not related to what you can see that she actually cares about. And like I didn't think there was much like desire or lust in any of this film at any point, but she's so tactile with everyone. And then I want to say that her relationship with Jimmy, the 5-year-old student, I think that often when I've heard and when I've described this film, when we start to say, oh, it's a teacher who has like an alarming relationship with her 5-year-old student, it is, but it's also not exploitative, and I don't think it delves into like the really horrible realms that I find myself instantly thinking, oh, if it goes bad, that means
is exploitative, just in another way you think.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but yeah,
exactly.
I think
yeah.
The film comes down, what's fascinating about the film, one of the things I disagree with it but other people might not, is that it kind of comes down on her side, I feel, especially the ending. And I think that's maybe a debate for another day.
I think so. But,
it's certainly one to let people figure out.
Because it would take ages.
No, let's go into it right now. Let's give people the ending.
But like, it does walk a tightrope, like you said.
Yeah.
But I just think occasionally it falls a little bit off that tightrope towards her side.
I think what is done really well is that the film never judges. I don't think it takes a hard line. It's mm-hmm. It's very nuanced film, actually. And I think it's directed really, really well in the sense that, like, you are kind of just following the story. And I found myself, you know, when I first saw it, I was like, I really flipped a lot. I was like, okay, I get behind that. No, I don't get behind that. Then I flip back and I was like, okay, I understand it. Like, it's really nuanced in the whole world, the whole way the world is created. You understand so much of her. She does have desires they might not be necessarily overtly sexual, but their other desires, you know, to express herself through art. She has desires. She's very sad and lonely. She's a lonely, lonely character. You know, she's very isolated. And you understand why she does certain things.
Her frustrations,
but they're not necessarily justifiable. Yeah. So I think that the film walks a tightrope in the sense that it's never taking a hard line to judge the character, and so it sucks you in really, because it is a slow burn, and it does, like, it starts to simmer, and then it gets like, it goes to a place like from the end to the beginning. You're like, how did it get here? But it really does kind of. It draws you in, and you kind of are along with her for the ride.
Yeah. And also her character. I think a lot of female-fronted films that we have been seeing recently and keep coming out, there seems to be a kind of a box-ticking way of building these characters, which is saying, is she strong? Does she look this way? Or is she a bit flawed? Is she a bit vulnerable as well? And I think, as you say, this film is so nuanced in that, like, you might side with her or you might not, but there's so many different ways that she flips, and she's not just this, like, messed up woman who's doing the silly things, and she's not, you know, an exemplary one either.
Yeah.
So Lisa Spinelli may not join the pantheon of great cinematic teachers, but we did put the call out on Twitter just in case anyone wanted to pitch in with some of their favorite teachers. I know mine instantly, as the question was put out there, had to be Dewey Finn, aka Ned Schneebly, aka Mr. S from School of Rock.
That is the best one, to be honest.
We had some other suggestions. Chase Carpenter said John Keating from Dead Poets Society. Wonderful Robin Williams performance. Kelly, any favorite teachers of yours?
Well, he's not really a teacher more than a coach, but Denzel's character in Remember the Titans. I love that movie.
I mean, neither
so
is
much.
Mr. Ass, so...
I guess.
Steve?
Me, I mean, I'm a big fan of Matilda, and I'm a big fan of Miss Honey. Arguably an awful teacher, but a lovely person. I'm going to go with Miss Honey.
And Ella, I mean, any opportunity to bring up another film starring Timothée Chalamet, really?
Look, I don't make the rules. I did not write or direct or have anything to do with Miss Stevens, but the film called Miss Stevens, starring Lily Rabe as Miss Stevens. Oh, sorry, to come back to the point at the beginning, Miss Stevens, that's allowed because it's a name.
Okay.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, okay, that's fine. We also had some suggestions from the same suggestion from Drew Padilla and Rob Kenny, who picked Half Nelson, and that was a film directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, and they've got a little indie flick out this week, a new one, a nice, maybe a little follow-up to Half Nelson. It's called Captain Marvel. Now, with nothing but a Furby, a choker necklace, and a copy of Windows 95 on a floppy disk, can Brie Larson's marvelous new hero save the 90s and possibly the future? We don't know. None of us have seen it. But
I'm going to edge my bets, and I think she will.
Yeah, I think she might just save the day. But I'm actually really excited about watching that.
It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we spoke earlier about these directors making these transitions, like going from, you would never have watched Half Nelson and thought, right, yeah, they're definitely going to do Captain Marvel. Always really interesting to see directors do something like that. But it's a huge week at the movies. We've also got Border. This is quite a wonderful love story between two modern day troll like humans. A little mention for Ray and Liz also out this week.
Absolutely. So Ray and Liz is the feature debut from photographer Richard Billingham, which revisits his own childhood via these characters, Ray and Liz, who are his parents. It's a beautiful, beautiful small film. Inevitably, with his eye as a photographer, it looks stunning. The acting is terrific. It's Ella Smith and Justin Salinger playing the titular characters. It's just explosive in how wonderful and beautiful it is. Really recommend that.
And if you cannot make it to the cinema this week, of course, there is also the option of Curzon Home Cinema. The new release on there this week is Sauvage, which in a weird twist was actually directed by your former film teacher, Ella.
It was indeed. It was a wonderful surprise when I saw that it was featured in the Critics Week section for debut features. So Sauvage is directed by Camille Vidal-Naquet, who's a French filmmaker, and it follows the life of a 22-year-old male sex worker who's working the streets in Strasbourg. And it's amazing. It's electrifying. It's so exciting. It doesn't take like a documentary kind of approach to just say, you know, this is the job. This is what people do. It's very tender and focused in on this character who is played by Félix Magdor, who this is his first like big lead role, really. He was kind of in the shadows of BPM, and you know, it was really terrific in that. And yeah, I think it's really exciting for him. And again, it's another film that doesn't judge the character. It just really has so many layers, and it's just wonderful.
Told you she was a teacher's pet. And as well as Sauvage, we've got a Fahadi collection if people want to catch up on titles like The Salesman, A Separation, before heading to see Everybody Knows. And of course, we've also got Foxtrot, which was our film of the week last week. And in case you missed that episode of the podcast, we delve into that film along with some of our other favourite foreign language war films too. If you've got any thoughts on Everybody Knows or The Kindergarten Teacher, or let us know any more of your favourite film teachers, you can do so by emailing podcast@curzon.com, or if it's easier, do just tweet us at Curzon Cinemas, where we'll be putting a call out for next week's topic as well. If it is your first time listening, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And whilst you're there, we'd love it if you could leave us a review or a comment. That would be wonderful. Next week, we'll be talking about Lucas Daunt's Girl, and also to Simon Amstel about his new film, Benjamin. If you want to keep up with us, you can do so on social media. You can follow Stephen on Letterboxd at...
Stephen Ryder with two R's at the end.
Lovely. Kelly on Twitter at...
KS_Powell.
Ella at...
EFE Kemp.
And me, if you are so desperate, at Jake H. Cunningham. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.